welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back and allowing me to be part of your week. In this week's episode, I have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Remy Smolinski. He is a professor at HHL Leipzig Graduate School of Management. Now, Dr. Smolinski brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to our discussion today as we explore the importance of negotiations, communication, and conflict management in building resilient relationships, privately and professionally. You know, Dr. Smolinski specializes in negotiation theory and practice in international settings and innovation management. His expertise makes him a true authority in the field. Today, we will dive into the essence of successful negotiation, defining what it means to negotiate well, and uncovering strategies to effectively navigate and overcome common pitfalls and challenges. Negotiation performance is crucial, and Dr. Smolinski will enlighten us on key indicators and metrics used to objectively assess the effectiveness of negotiation outcomes. We'll also gain insights into innovative approaches and strategies that have emerged in the field of negotiation, exploring their impact on the negotiation landscape. You know, negotiating across cultures and diverse backgrounds presents unique challenges. And Dr. Smolinski will share his expertise on the application of negotiation principles in international settings, offering valuable advice for successfully managing these complexities. And for all of you aspiring negotiators, Dr. Smolinski will share his insights and the critical skills and qualities that you should cultivate to become successful negotiators. We'll also delve into the topic of self-confidence and self-doubt in negotiations, exploring their impact on the process and the effective management techniques. So join me now as we uncover the secrets of successful negotiations and its role in building resilient relationships and organizations. So without further ado, let's slip into the stream and meet Dr. Remy Smolinski.
My name is Remy Smolinski, indeed, and I'm a negotiation professor at HHL, Leipzig Graduate School of Management. I'm also a negotiation consultant. I help executives and companies solve their complex negotiation problems. And I also run a negotiation competition called the Negotiation Challenge for students and professionals.
A lot of people may picture negotiations in maybe in the more traditional sense of working out a deal. Could you expand on the definition of negotiation and how it's important in our day-to-day lives if we are not taught negotiators per se?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for this question. Let's develop some common understanding what hides behind this very commonly used word, but rarely understood properly. So negotiation, we negotiate whenever two people want to do something together and have different preferences with respect to how. And this is probably the simplest definition, but let us dissect it into smaller pieces. Yes. So for example, the differences in preferences can manifest themselves on various levels. Yes. Very classic example that we very often used as negotiation professor or trainers is couples going on vacation. Yes, where they want to enjoy. Yes, you're smiling probably.
I've been there.
Yes, exactly. And many of us have. Yes. So we have a common goal. Yes, we want to spend time together. We want to relax. We want to enjoy the quality time. But we might have different preferences with respect to where. Yes, one of us is more active, the other one needs maybe a little bit more quiet time off of the civilization. Maybe someone wants to visit the big cities, large cities. Yes. So there are lots of possibilities for potential conflict. Yes. But there is a certain common characteristic of all negotiation situations, and that is that we envision that a potential agreement unlocks value for both of us. Yes. What does this mean? Well, when we finally manage to agree on where and how, right, we will enjoy our time together even better. Yes. This is a very common example for often encountered in relationships. But if we make the transition to business, it looks identically or analogically, right? So we also have situations where buyers and sellers have radically different interests, right? The buyer wants to spend as little money as she possibly can, whereas the seller wants to maximize his margins, right? But at the same time, none of them gets anything if they don't manage to find a deal that meets the expectations of both. And so a very common characteristic of interdependence between each other, this interdependence is what unlocks value at the end of the day, right? So the seller might have an object or assets, right, which are redundant or which they want to get rid of or liquidate or exchange for money. Yes. Whereas the buyer has liquid resources, typically money, and a need for those assets. Yes. But none of them gets anything, neither the profit nor the value that could be potentially generated by those assets if they don't find a deal. So interdependence is one common characteristic then, and an intention to come to a deal. And while having differences, different preferences, different interests when it comes to the details of the deal, such as, for example, the destination in the relationship question of a vacation question, or, for example, price, a very common negotiation in sales or procurement.
I think one of the words you said is negotiations. You know, the pretext of a negotiation is, at some level, a conflict, different interests. We come from different backgrounds. For many of us, there is a negative connotation to the word conflict. If we were to broaden the perspective of conflict, how should we look at conflict above and beyond sort of the negative connotations or aspects of that definition of the word?
Yes, Jason, thank you for this question, because yes, indeed, at the core of every negotiation, there is a conflict. Yes, I describe it as a conflict between preferences, but this can be more or less intensive, right? It can be just a pretext to a dialogue about what's important to you, or it can be a highly emotional, sometimes even coercive conflict, like the one that we are expecting, that we are experiencing in Ukraine, right? So when it comes to conflict, whenever there are two individuals who have different preferences, they are experiencing conflict. The intensity of conflict varies or may vary, right? I keep saying during my training and my lectures, my courses, that it is not the frequency of conflict that is wrong or bad. Conflict can be constructive. Conflict can lead to, you know, discovering more about each other. Conflict can be creative. Might lead to developing new solutions. Conflict might, even strengthen relationships. Right. So conflict per se is not bad, or the frequency of conflict is not bad. Yeah. It's our ability to handle it that we can and need to think about, rethink, and master, right? And that's exactly where negotiation kicks in, right? Negotiation allows us to deal with conflict better. Negotiation allows us to transform conflict into something which is constructive, something that is productive, right? So it's not so much the fact of avoiding it or so much of reducing its frequency. Mm-hmm. It's much more transforming, managing it, handling the conflict, right? And this is exactly my little mission, you know, and the mission probably of everyone who deals with negotiation, mediation, right, or other aspects, other ways of resolving conflict. We are there to help people handle the conflict, the differences in preferences between them and their partners.
You know, I think the skill of negotiation itself, it is sort of a verbal martial arts. There are different, if I can call it, belts of skill to be adept at it. For me, negotiation is a key skill. I mean, you don't have to be a top negotiator, but if you understand the fundamentals, because I think moving forward, when we talk about cooperation or collaboration or communication, negotiation is one of those foundational stones that are needed to lead people, to lead ourselves. I mean, because sometimes we need to negotiate with ourselves. And I think what you said was, I liked your definition, how you articulated conflict. If we can see it, you said to see new solutions, to build or strengthen relationships. Because if we get over who can get over sort of the limited definition of conflict as something negative, as something intrusive, as something abrasive, but see it as, on the other side of the fence, what it will achieve, a better outcome, a better relationship, a better solution. I really like your definition. And I think this reframing can encourage people to have more difficult or hard conversations, whether it's a deal or whether it's working out some sort of professional, personal difference. So I really like that. If I just can shift maybe to broaden the perspective before we kind of do a deeper dive, as a negotiation professor, as someone who has extensive experience, how would you define the essence of a successful negotiation? I mean, what does it mean to negotiate well? I know that's a very open, broad question, but please interpret as you will.
Thank you, Jason, for asking it. Let us take a step back. Negotiation science is not super old, right? I mean, the first papers were published in the 60s, 70s. A major wave came with Harvard's program on negotiation in the 80s. So we're looking at about four decades of research, four plus. Yes. Interestingly enough, in over 40 years, we have not managed to develop a consensus on what it means to negotiate well, and there have been attempts here and there to somehow capture the most important characteristics of superior negotiation results. Let me try to guide our listeners through some of them. Yes, I think the most important one where it all starts is something what we call a substantive outcome. And a substantive outcome is what we get at the end, right? When there is a handshake, is the price that we get, delivery conditions, payment terms, or the destination for our vacation trip, right? Or whatever else we might, or peace treaty, the conditions of a peace treaty, right, between two nations. These are the examples that we tackled, right? And these are the conditions, the terms of an agreement. These are substantive outcomes, right? Sometimes we can measure them, especially in transactional context. Typically, they can have a price tag or value, right? That we can often decipher in money or in code in money, right? And to compare, okay, was it good? Was it not? Sometimes it's non-numerical. Mm-hmm. It's only based on our subjective perception of the conditions. But nevertheless, substantive outcome is the first dimension. So we know that the buyer that manages to negotiate a lower price is a better negotiator than the buyer who keeps on paying more. Right, when we think about it, it's kind of short-sighted, right? Especially those of us who are in business know that 80-90% of business relationships are long-term, are not one-shot, right? And this is this means that that apparently next to substantive outcome, there must be also something that indicates the strength of that relationship or the quality of that relationship. And this is literature calls it a subjective outcome or relational outcome. And this is something that I believe is also important and needs to be considered, especially in negotiations which are not about, you know, selling a car or buying real estate or, I don't know, buying a used bike on a classified through a classified service, right? So whenever there is a certain perspective or certain probability that a there will be a follow-up negotiation at some point, right, that the relationship is ongoing or repeated, we must include in the measurement of negotiation success or in the measurement of negotiation performance, we must include the impact that our actions, communication. One thing that we didn't mention while defining negotiation is that it's also ultimately essentially a communication process, right? So it's the thing that we say or the things that we say, right? And these things have impact on both of these dimensions. So the ability, our ability to solve a problem, meaning find the right price or a destination that we can live with, but also, as we're solving the problem, we are building or destroying the relationship. Okay, and these are let's say most commonly considered the most important outcomes or the most important measurements of negotiation success. We also, when we run negotiation competitions, we also have a closer look at the process, not only at the outcome, but also at the process, right? Why do we do so? Right? Because negotiation is ultimately a dyadic process, and dyadic interactive process. What does it mean? Mm. It involves at least two parties, sometimes more, right? And these two parties respond to each other's actions. To the stimuli that they generate, yes, and therefore, to looking only at the outcome is a little bit it's a little bit short-sighted because it doesn't include the contributions or doesn't consider the contributions that were that have been made by the participating party throughout the process. So, and these contributions are can differ. Yes, it can be that, you know, the fact that I got a great relational or we got a great relational outcome in a particular negotiation might be completely attributed to the actions of my partner, not mine. Right. So I might just, might as a negotiator might have benefited from my partner's negotiation skill. So what we also do is very often. In our negotiation competitions, we have judges who observe the process and at the end make the shots or call the shots who are the ones who manage this process better. Yeah? But in general, these are the three dimensions that differentiate good negotiation or superior negotiation performance from let's say just outcomes, looking at the substance, looking at the relationship and the contribution to those outcomes and the relationship along the process.
So if I rewind just to put a bow on this, so some of the metrics used to measure negotiation performance, there's this, as you said, there's a substantive outcome. So we can call that sort of the quantitative. Those could be the numbers or the hard lines above things. Then there's also what you've talking about is the subjective outcome or the contribution. And these are the qualitative. You know, I've been working in communication for a long time. The quantitative tend to be, they can be easier to define, but it's the qualitative. We talk a lot about sort of the soft skills needed in communication. You know, coming from a clinical and cognitive science background, excuse me, for me, those soft skills are sometimes the hardest skills to learn because you need to navigate and negotiate, literally negotiate very emotional terrain. When it comes to that, like if we're looking at negotiations and obviously, there's a lot of emotions that can get involved depending upon how vested we are in what needs to be solved or resolved. From your experience, how does someone deal with the emotional aspect if they're getting agitated or frustrated or they're impatient? How does an individual deal with that in the midst of a negotiation or a
conflict? Right. Yes, and that's one of the most difficult aspects of the negotiation process that we need to manage, right? But you correctly pointed out that it's not a pure rational exercise, right? Where we have knowns, unknowns, we put them next to each other, and all of a sudden we can calculate what the X was, right? What the outcome was, right? That maximizes the value for me, or maximizes the value for both of us, right? So that's when emotions get involved, it becomes significantly more difficult to reach a deal. And the reason is because our emotions kick in sooner. Yes, they tend to escalate. And number three, our emotions inhibit or worsen the way we can think about, we can think rationally. Yes. What does it, let us take it apart. All these bits and pieces. Yes.
Please, please.
So emotions kick in whenever we experience something which is called a trigger. Yes. We might have different trigger, right? So for some of us, it might be, you know, our integrity, our authority, our status, right? So when people question us, question how ethical we are, when people accuse us of something that we didn't do, mm-hmm. right? For me, my trigger is truth. And it's very strong. I was thinking about it a lot, and I noticed that I tend to react emotionally whenever I experience a situation in which my negotiation partners simply are frugal with the facts. Yes. And this self-reflection, knowing where our triggers are, is also super helpful in terms of our ability to manage them. Whenever those triggers appear in the process, they sparkle an emotional, a hormone cocktail in our body, mm-hmm. right? Emotional reaction, which means we get upset, we get irritated, we get frustrated, but we can also, you know, get happy with certain emotional triggers. So emotions can be positive and negative, but we typically, probably what you meant were are negative emotions, right? Because they very often stand in our way of reaching a good deal. So they appear instantly whenever we experience whatever triggers us. And then they tend to raise in intensity very, very quickly. And so it's like from zero to a highly emotional, highly upset state in a very, very short time, within a few seconds. We're talking about a few seconds, right? Our body does not need much time to produce enough hormones to simply negatively impact our rational or cognitive abilities. Yes. So they shoot up, and the more intensive our emotional reactions tend to be, the less we're able to solve problems. Yeah? So the weaker the cognitive reaction to that particular situation. Yes. But it's very interesting. It's very interesting to think about what happens as you know, seconds turn into minutes, minutes turn into hours, right? Mm-hmm. It's impossible to sustain a highly intensive emotional reaction for a long time. It's impossible. This is how our bodies have been built, and it's probably for our self-protection, which means that at some point, regardless how upset we are, how frustrated we are, how angry or furious we might be, this emotional reaction will fade away with time. Mm. As we can keep on recalling it, we can keep on fueling it with time, but as it fades out, as the intensity fades away, right, our cognitive abilities increase or improve. Mm. right? So, and that's why did I mention this? I think it's very important to understand the emotional response, the logic or the dynamics of emotional responses to answer your original question, how to deal with them. Yes? So the best way of dealing with emotional reactions, outbursts, and so on is to let them vent off, right? Is to wait. Yes? By no means interrupt, by no means providing additional fuel, by no means getting into an argument. Simply listening. Listening, showing, and then whenever we have a feeling that the intensity of those emotional reactions decrease or have significantly decreased, by no means questioning their legitimacy. And this is one of the very common mistakes that beginner negotiators very frequently make, and that is, you know, there is no reason to be upset. It's a typical claim, typical sentence that we we often hear or say, in especially in relationships, right? Totally wrong. Totally wrong. That that claim provides additional fuel for those who feel emotionally upset, because this is the reality. This is the reality. This is how they feel, and so apparently there is some legitimacy to it. Yes. So instead of questioning the legitimacy, we just simply wait, and at the end, recognize what we've observed, meaning, hey, it looks like this is a very important topic to you. Let us think about what we can do to solve it. So divert the attention from the problem towards the solution. And so, and this is what I very often recommend both in my lectures, courses, but also at the negotiating table. Yes, let it vent. Yes, I know we feel an urge to correct. We feel an urge to inject our words of wisdom. Yeah, waiting is a much better policy. And then at the end, instead of questioning what has just happened or diminishing its importance, it's much more strategic and reasonable to think to first of all recognize it as an important recognize the source of emotions as an important part of the negotiation, and divert or direct the attention towards the solution.
You know, Remy, you and I come from two different disciplines, but when you speak of how to deal with emotional outbursts or emotional contagion, I see a lot of parallels in what we do. Because what I hear you say, if I may rewind, is let them vent, let them talk, let them articulate their thoughts and emotions and get it out there. Because a lot of the times, that's what it is. It's to unplug that, and that allows them to address whatever is bothering them. The other one, as you said, key is to listen, is to sit there and reflectively listen to what they're saying. And I think what's important here is also, what I hear is also validate their emotions, right? At least recognize, and I see you're frustrated by this, and I can understand. Can you please explain a little more about what's going on? It's to let them to elaborate. And so I see a lot of parallels in what we're talking about. But all of these skills, especially in intense situations, that's why I think the qualitative side of communication is so important, to be able to practice in low intensity interactions, you know, picking the low hanging fruit, per se. Because to listen, I mean, you need to actually be consciously, you need to be cognizant to actually listen and to stop coming up with solutions or telling people to relax when they are all worked up, because that's the worst thing you can do. It's yes, like pressing the trigger. You were talking about it. Oh yeah, here you go. Go explode, right? So you don't tell people to relax, or you try to minimize their emotions, because once you validate their emotions, they feel listened to. And validating and venting is, for me, has always been a great way to de-escalate the emotion so you can get back onto a level playing field to discuss. But if I may, on the other side, if it's me who's getting emotional, if it's me who's building up, and I can see the other person is kind of telling me to relax, or, you know, This is just normal procedures. And I feel the not listening. I feel the emotions building up in me. What can I do on my side to kind of de-escalate my own emotion in the in the midst of the conflict, which can be very difficult?
Mm-hmm. Yes, very, very important question, right? We typically talk about emotions as if they were only felt by the other side, right? The other evil side, especially when we think about negative emotions. But every human being consists of ratio and emotio, right? I mean, our ability to think analytically, right? Dissect problems, solve problems, right? But also our ability to experience feelings, right? Even us, regardless of how much we would like to think that we are purely rational, experience emotional situations, and that's okay. That's a part of our humanity, right? Mm-hmm. There's a great book which I would like to recommend, which Please. Is called Collywobbles, written by Moshe Cohen. Moshe is a negotiation professor in Boston, one of Boston universities, that book is exactly devoted to how to deal with, why negotiating is a highly emotional process, and how to deal with exactly that part of it, which means not so much, you know, how to solve problems, but how to deal with that emotional load. And I think there are, let me say, two or three things that I could share that Moshe describes in a little bit more detail Please. In his book. And number one is, I think the key to addressing or to managing our emotions at the table is self-reflection, and which means knowing what triggers us as individuals. And we have different triggers, right? From our past experience, past negotiation experience, we need to somehow recall, dissect them, and think about, okay, why was I upset? What made me upset? Was it the process? Was it the person? Was it something that they say? What did they say that made me upset? Right? And this is how we recognize what triggers us. Mm-hmm. And this is how we recognize what triggers us so that we can be prepared. Mm-hmm. Right? When the next negotiation takes place, right? So we immediately understand, I'm getting, is it that the trigger? Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Oh, whoops, I might get upset very soon, right? So that's the first thing. And then what happens when we get upset, right? Two things. One, very often, very frequently recommended is breathe. Mm-hmm. Focus on your breathing. Right? Just like in labor, right? Keep on breathing. Breathe in, breathe out. Highly emotional stress situation, diverting the attention from what is going on and focusing on mindful breathing slows down physiological reactions connected to stress. Mm. So that's one thing. And the second is slowing things down. I remember some time ago I spoke with a negotiation professor from Singapore, Joel Lee, who is also a black belt Wing Chun martial arts teacher, has his own school in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I will never forget that he always recommends. We spoke about various things, and among others, the similarities between martial arts and negotiation or conflict resolution. One of the things that we tackled is, mastering martial arts has taught him about negotiation. And he said exactly this, reacting to or managing emotional responses. Yes. Mm-hmm. Typically when we get triggered, our mind. And so limbic system demands a reaction or triggers a reaction. Yes. And he says, well, but we can control it to a certain extent by slowing things down. And that's exactly how he does, how he describes slow things down. Mm-hmm. So you will also find it in Collie Wobbles. Moshe Cohen says exactly the same thing, which means we do not need to respond. And when we feel upset, we can take a break. We can recognize that we are upset. We can think about an answer. We can ask a question and divert the attention, let's say, from, or no, not divert the attention, but shift the process either, you know, by slowing it down or giving the ball back to whoever just triggered our emotional response. So slowing things down, it's the third thing. The first one is knowing what triggers us so that we are prepared. And while emotional reactions are developing, breathing in, breathing out.
I think those are three solid examples. You know, just to complement that, when I'm coaching, you know, people and they know they have to have a difficult conversation with an employee or with a client or a customer, what have you, and they know it's going to be emotionally entangled and they know it will escalate at some point, what I tell them sometimes is, you know, take something that is, take an object into the negotiating room, something that you can put on the table. It might be a little pebble you got from a favorite creek in your local ravine or something, but something that stands out, because when it sits in front of you, it's inconspicuous. Nobody else is going to really notice it, but you will notice it. Or it may be just a post-it note, a bright neon post-it note with nothing on it. And you place that on the table. And when you start feeling the intensity, as you said, the trigger, when you look at that paper, that physical anchor becomes a reminder for you to be self-aware, to be cognizant. Okay, as you said, to slow down my breathing or to reflect or to bounce it back, to giving me time to process my emotions by asking them a question, to articulate their meaning, to describe or tell what they're thinking or the reason they've asked. So for me, I think everything you've said is so solid. And I think what would help me to, if I start getting entangled, sometimes I think you said it's sort of, it limits scope. When you get emotionally intense, it limits your scope. You don't see the breadth of different solutions or different ways out. And sometimes having that physical anchor can help people to kind of, okay, step back and get a more objective distance from the subjective storm that they may be feeling.
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. Yes. I'll try it to have a small pebble, small object that simply reminds us, hey, there are ways out of it, right? There are ways out of it. We are not victims. Yes, it's hard to control our physiological reactions to stress or to, it's very hard to reduce cognitive load, but it's possible. Yes, we can do it. And we just need a kick under the table or an object that reminds us, hey, okay, you are getting there. Start breathing or slow things down.
In part one, Remy talked about and provided us with valuable insights on negotiation and conflict management. He defined negotiation as the possible agreement that unlocks potential for both parties. We also explored the idea of conflict and that conflict can be seen in a constructive light. Conflict, according to Dr. Smolinski, is not solely about conflicting preferences, but can be creative and lead to developing new solutions and strengthening the bonds of relationships. The key lies in our ability to handle and master conflict, transforming it into something constructive. Dr. Smolinski highlighted three dimensions of a good negotiation. The first is the substantive outcome, which focuses on the quantitative aspects in the term of agreement. The second dimension is the objective or relationship level, which is more qualitative and considers the ongoing communication and the impact on the negotiation process. Building or destroying the relationship happens simultaneously as we solve the problem at hand. The third dimension is the process itself, emphasizing the importance of respecting each other's actions and contributions throughout the negotiations, rather than solely focusing on the outcome. And there's no denying that emotions play a significant role in negotiations, and Dr. Smolinski shares strategies for handling them effectively. He explored that highly emotional states are not sustainable over a long period of time, and that will naturally fade, allowing cognition and rational thinking to return. When faced with emotional outbursts, it's best to let people vent by simply listening without offering suggestions or questioning the legitimacy of their emotions. Validation is crucial, recognizing and acknowledging the observed emotions without rushing to correct or provide solutions. Instead, adopting a philosophy of asking rather than telling can help explore their reasoning and promote a more constructive negotiation environment. Now, as we transition into the second part of our episode, we will delve deeper into other essential aspects of negotiation, communication, and conflict management. So now let's slip back into the stream, into part two, where Dr. Smolinski will continue to share his expertise, guiding us on the path toward building resilient relationships and organizations. A lot of the listeners here may have people in their companies, on their teams, they may lead people where they have to negotiate across cultures or diverse backgrounds. And that can always be a challenge. What insights have you gained about the application of negotiation principles in sort of in such contexts?
Yes, that's it's a very good question, and many people have thought about an answer for a long time. And there were huge books that have been written on cross-cultural or the impact of cross-cultural aspects. Mm-hmm. On the applicability of methods. Excuse me. So let me find the right tone for the time that we have that we have for our conversation. I think it's important to us to recognize that first of all, what culture is, right? Mm-hmm. It's the ability we process information. It's that is common for a certain group of people. And this filter, the cultural filters, have an impact on lots of things, among others, how we interpret what we hear. Mm-hmm. As during a negotiation process. So the methods that we teach, right? We'd love to think that they are universal, and some of them are more universal than others. So, for example, there's a very famous book on negotiation called Getting to Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a bestseller, sold in millions of copies, and it's exactly the book that was written, at least the first edition, in the 80s, mm-hmm. By Roger Fisher and Bill Urey and Bruce Patton. Those were the first professors at Harvard's program on negotiation. And for many, many years and decades, we all thought that the principles sketched in Getting to Yes are universal. Mm-hmm. But our current research shows that they aren't. That there are cultures in which they work better, mm-hmm. and there are cultures in which maybe too risky. Yeah. It has something to do with the amount of resources we can risk, how wealthy a society is, has an impact on the ability to share, or let's say develop trust and share information, right? Just sketching it roughly. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, I think these insights apply to many methods which we believe that we've believed that are universal, but ultimately some of them might not be as universal as we had thought. So I think it's important to keep it in the back of our mind that culture matters. Yes, we are all human beings, so the things that we, for example, things which are inherent to us as human beings, they will remain universal. So things like relationship building or trust or the importance of trust is universal. The ways of building it may be culturally dependent. Yeah. Which means every culture or many cultures have developed different methods for trust buildings, right? So, for example, in France, and now I'm operating with some stereotypes, but these stereotypes do not come from nothing, right? They have
truth.
This exactly. They have some basis in statistics. So, in France, we built trust by eating together, by having a joint meal. In Eastern Europe, we build trust by drinking together. In other cultures, we build trust by spending time together, and so on and so on, or inviting people to our homes, right? So there are various ways of addressing the trust issue, which work better in some cultures and not so well in others. Yes, but the underlying principle, right, that trust is important in repeated or long-term interactions or relationships is universal. So to sum it up, I think this is a very good question. Culture does have an impact on negotiation. I think that there is absolutely no scientist, no researcher who would question that that statement anymore, right? And the more... Whereas some of the insights that we've gained over the four decades of research, some of the insights that we've gained still remain universal because they are very close to who we are and what we are as human beings, right? So, in short, culture matters.
I think that's very important because if we reduce the scope here, and let's say it's a manager who has an international team and there's multiple cultures on that team, I think to simplify things and to find a more a level playing field, I think what is very important is to establish rules of engagement amongst the members of those teams. Because if you have that, and maybe to address the elephants in the room, and it might be, look, guys, we all come from different cultures here, and I understand we have certain sensitivities and that can add very much complexity, but we as a team that have to move something forward, perhaps we should spend a couple hours defining some rules of engagement. So when myself as a Canadian asking you a direct question, it is just meant to as exploratory, not as an accusation. And you know, if you can talk about some of these cultural differences amongst a team, again, this is a microcosm of the bigger things. But I think if you can establish those standards amongst the team, then I think you will mitigate some of the sensitivities or the minefields that having cultural differences can trigger. Now, again, I'm not talking about nation to nations. That's completely different. But I'm talking about a small team that is multicultural and to establish some standards so you can get on with doing businesses and people understand that my intentions are noble. They're not nefarious in some sort of things. That's just from my perspective.
Jason, I think you touched a very important point, and that is, in my answer, I focus mostly on national level cultures, but cultures can be also built within organizations. Corporate culture or organizational culture is a phenomenon that occurs on meso or micro level, right? Where a set of people, sometimes from different national backgrounds, national cultures, agree on a set of norms and standards that are acceptable to all of them, and then decide to base their interactions within that organization on those norms, right? So what I'm describing right now is exactly what also you described in your account, in your answer, right? Which means rules of engagement, that you said. These are the norms, standards, right, that companies develop, to manage the diversity in national backgrounds, national cultures. So it says basically, well, it doesn't matter where you're from. Here, this is the list of things that are important for us as an organization, and these might be different things. These are typically things that are shared by, you know, this the management, the executives, or the shareholders, or whoever, whatever you might you might have, right? But there is an intention to establish those as the basic rules of engagement, regardless or despite the diversity in national cultures that it might impact and encompass within this this organization.
And I think I can completely concur with what you're saying, Remy, because at the end of the day, it's about addressing the elephants, those minefields, those cultural minefields, or whatever minefields it is, and to have a frank and open conversation. Because if we constantly worry about people feeling offended, people will feel offended. Fine. That's your right. But the question is, if we are going to strengthen our relationships, if we're going to find some sort of solution to whatever conundrum we're trying to face, then it means sometimes having difficult conversations, and sometimes people will get offended. But as you so eloquently articulated before, there are ways of de-escalating emotions and dealing with emotions, both on the other side of the table, but with ourselves. And so I have another question for you, maybe in regards, and I think you've already answered to some degree. You know, if we were to look at critical skills for negotiations, are there any specific techniques or mindsets you would emphasize to in what you teach? Because I know you've written a book, you run negotiation competitions and such, in order to help individuals to become more proficient negotiators.
Well, the entire book behind me is full with recommendations and methods. And
first thing that comes to mind, like for you as an individual, not just a professor, but when you go into negotiations, what is the mindset? Like, what is the mind talk you tell yourself? What is the narrative you prepare yourself when you go into that? Like, what are you cognizant of when you go into a very difficult or a hard conversation or difficult negotiation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I try to recommend in my consulting engagements, or when I negotiate for myself or for my clients, I have a picture of a panda bear in the back of my mind. Yes, and let me maybe explain why and what it means. So over the years, or over, I don't know, 70 years of running our negotiation competition, we've noticed that the teams that are doing extremely well, our winners, our champions, have two common characteristics. Yes? So the first one is probably no surprise. Yes, these guys are well prepared. They know their trade. And so many teams joining our competitions are, if we're talking about students, the competition for students takes place in spring, typically in March. Mm-hmm. The students get selected in October in previous year, and they undergo a structured preparation process. So their negotiation professors select them, teach them, coach them, right, so that they can compete on the highest levels. So knowing the trade matters. Yes, and we also see it among professionals. Yes, we see it among the professionals. These are super experienced sales, procurement people, lawyers, M&A people as well, right? Mm-hmm. People who negotiate huge deals, right? Huge deals. So they typically, most of them, have had prior negotiation training. Yes, and they know what value creation means, what value claiming means, and so on. So this, what do I mean? I mean the strength, yes, the strength in tackling the problem. Yeah? But just like panda bears are not, you know, these are not insects, right? These are bears. They are very strong. They are very strong. And I think one of my Chinese students told me that in old Chinese, pandas, panda bears are referred to as animals that can bite or go through steel, yeah, or bite through steel. I think that's what she said, right? Mm. So this simply illustrates that that despite their appearance, and I will say a few words about that in a minute, despite their appearance, they are still strong. As what is the analogy to negotiation? Being strong means having the ability to tackle complex problems, mm-hmm. as knowing how to deal with complex negotiation issues. So knowing our trade, as being hard on the problem, as one of the famous books on negotiation said. But at the same time, when we look at panda bears, we probably don't feel fear. We probably are not intimidated by them. Yes, we feel their cuteness. We see exactly. We recognize their clumsiness. Mm. Right. We think, oh, there is absolutely no threat that can come from an animal like this. Right. Mm. So we tend to underestimate their strength. And this is what panda negotiation or panda bear negotiation or being like a panda bear in negotiation needs to be like, right? So coming across as someone who is friendly, polite, kind, someone who is no threat, maybe even a little clumsy. Yes. You probably remember Detective Columbo.
Yeah, that's exactly what the character coming to my head right now, Columbo. For those
exactly,
we and just to, age ourselves, man.
Yes, exactly. So we seem to be in a similar age.
Right?
If we remember Detective Columbo, and Detective Columbo wanted exactly to create, or the character played by Peter Falk wanted to create exactly this effect, right? Why? Because then the criminals or the suspects did not lower their guard. Mm. Yes, at some point they said, this guy probably is no good, right? He's not smart. This guy poses no threat, so I can lower my guard. And this is exactly the effect that that the panda bear negotiating style needs to create in at the negotiating table, meaning the worst thing that I can do in the negotiation is to come across as someone who is too powerful, who is too eloquent, who is too assertive, who is too smart. Why? Because this is our natural reaction to threat, obviously fight or flight. Yeah? And none of these reactions are super conductive or super helpful toward reaching a good negotiation agreement. Yeah. So what we need is cooperation. And now let's reverse engineer that and think about who do we like to cooperate with? Certainly not with those who impose things on us. Mm-hmm. Certainly not with those who treat us with disrespect, right? We want to cooperate with those who are fun, who are nice, who are kind, who those we like. Yes. And this combination of methodological strength with likable appearance. Yes, is exactly the panda bear effect that I keep on preaching and teaching in my engagements. Yes, because we notice that this is super effective at the negotiating table. This is exactly the combination. This is exactly the combination that our negotiation champions were able to display. Yes, coming across as no threat, coming across as likable negotiators, coming across as friends, and at the same time having this sort of a back end of strength, methodological strength, knowing their trade, as knowing, you know, what they want to get and how they could potentially get it.
And I really like what you said, that sort of panda bear, because you've kind of segued into my next question, but I'll approach that in a second, because what I hear is that a negotiator is also a diplomat, and that these two words could almost be synonymous, because when you think of being diplomatic, that means just that. Diplomatic is to listen, is to be empathic, but it's also to be hard on the problem, or as you said, hard on the problem, soft on the people. I think that's the general quote, but it's to push things forward. Part of what you do, you have a metaphor of a panda in the back of your head when you go into negotiations. I was wondering, from your experience, again, I'm just respectful of your time, Remy, when it comes to someone learning, moving into the world of negotiation, and he or she wants to develop and sharpen their skills. But a lot of people are sometimes hindered by self-critical thoughts and self-doubt. How, from your experience, can they squash that and feed their self-confidence so they can approach it
Super important question. I will never forget a conversation I had with one of the participants in our negotiation competition for professionals. Yes. Mm-hmm. She was super smart, very successful in her professional career, working at one of the largest automobile manufacturers. At some point, our paths have crossed, and she somehow was thinking about participating, whether she should or shouldn't participate in our negotiation competition. And she said, we spoke about it after it ended, and she told me, I was very hesitant. I never considered myself a great negotiator. I never thought, I always saw shortcomings. I always perceived myself as someone who maybe gives in too much, someone who's not a great negotiator. I always had a feeling that negotiation matters. Yes, that this is how I need to lead my team. This is how I'm being led by my managers, right? Especially in organizations which are based on consensus. Leadership is negotiation. Yes. So first of all, the insight, she understood the importance of the activity, and at the same time did not consider herself a good negotiator. And then she decided to join the competition, to enter the competition anyway. Yes. And then at the end, she told me this was the best thing I could have ever done. Yes. This gave me the self confidence, the ability to compare myself with others. Yes. It helped me realize that actually my negotiating style does require improvements, but still is good in certain ways. Mm-hmm. So, why am I mentioning? Anna was her name. Why am I mentioning Anna here in our podcast in this episode? I think it's super important to keep in the back of our mind where confidence comes from. Yes, confidence is a function of experience. Yes, and as such, how can we make the experience that improves our belief that we can master even more complex tasks? Mm-hmm. So, and there are only two possibilities. Number one is training. Mm. Yeah. Number one is training, meaning, brushing up the skills. Yeah. Learning what negotiating is all about. Many people think, as long as I can talk, I can negotiate. And that is true. Yeah. But this is only partially true because there are differences between negotiating and negotiating well, as we discussed at the beginning, right? So to negotiate well, we need training. Yes, negotiation is a skill. Yes, just like sports, music.
Well, it's a habit. It's a skill that needs developed, and that
exactly
comes from practice, learning, and
then precisely and structured feedback. And structured feedback, right? So we can practice without training, but what we need is also someone or something, a reference point based on the comparison with which we can somehow assess whether we're doing something well or not. And this is typically for that we need a trainer, a coach, professor. Or, I don't know, really good material that, or AI maybe at some point that tells us how well we are doing. So that's the first thing, training, mm-hmm. right? Confidence comes from experience, and experience, one of the sources of experience is training. Yeah? Number two is confidence comes from comparisons. Mm-hmm. Yes? And this comparison is rarely possible in practice. And the reason is because typically, even in companies that have a extended sales or sales force or large procurement teams, typically negotiators deal with different regions, are assigned to different regions, are assigned to different products, negotiations take place at a different time point. Yes, so that makes it all combined makes it impossible to compare performance between individuals. So I might be generating less revenue as a salesperson, but maybe it's because my clients, you know, the group of my clients or the geography or the product that I've been assigned to is difficult, more difficult, right? So how can we gain this confidence? Be like Anna, join the competition, yes? By doing so, the worst thing that can happen, yes, you will get feedback how to become a better negotiator. And the best thing that can happen is through your actions and results, you will understand how good you already are.
So what I'd like to do, I think that's a natural segue into talking about the negotiation challenge. You have the negotiation challenge for 2023 coming up. I was wondering, could you speak a little more to this? And if people are interested, what is it and how do they sign up or what level do they have to be? Maybe just some of the fundamentals.
Absolutely. So the negotiation challenge is a global negotiation competition. We have two versions. One is for students. One is for professionals. The one for professionals is coming up this fall, with a registration deadline being October 1st. Everything else is very simple. Mm. As long as you are a negotiator, a passionate negotiator, someone who this activity, this skill is important and critical in terms of professional success. Mm-hmm. So a salesperson, account manager, procurement person, or a lawyer, a diplomat, whoever, right? It doesn't really matter. We've had all sorts of participants in our competition from Nagoya, Japan to San Francisco. It's spread across nearly all continents, I think, except the polars. If you're interested or passionate about the topic and would like to invest some time, it's not much, but some time into understanding how good you really are, basically, you need to go to our website, which is thenegotiationchallengewrittentogether.org. Yes, and click on the competition for professionals and simply register. Yes, and that's all it takes. We're going to kick it off in October. Yes, the first round takes place in October. Negotiations take place online. So the participants are matched randomly with other negotiators who might be in a different time zone, from a different industry. And that's also one of the benefits that you get, right? You get to network with like-minded individuals for whom negotiation is equally important as it is to you. And then you will have a window of about a week to schedule, conduct, complete negotiation, and submit its result. Yes? And this repeats three times. And this repeats three times with every time with different negotiation partner, with a different negotiation partner. And the results aggregate, right? The results aggregate. Last round takes place with a jury. And so there will be judges observing the process. Yes, and evaluating your performance, and performance from all four rounds, the ones which are conducted without judges and the one with judges, are aggregated together, and whoever has the most points becomes our negotiation world champion.
It sounds like the Olympics of negotiations.
We love to think about it as a world championship in negotiation, an unofficial world championship in negotiation, because you know it fulfills certain criteria that the championship needs to tackle, which means it's open, as there is no proprietary methodology that is attached to it. We have very transparent, research-driven evaluation criteria, right? And in principle, anyone can join, right? So this is just exactly what I know. It's our scale is not comparable with track and field or any other big international world championship events, right? But we're working on it. We're working on it.
I will be sure to leave all the links in the show notes, as well as links to your book. Remy, I'm very thankful and grateful for your time. As we close our conversation today, are there any last tips or advice you could give to our listeners if they going into a hard conversation, a difficult conversation about vacation or pay or with employee?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Be panda bears. Be like a panda. And I think this is, if there's one one thing to remember, I think this is a very, very, very illustrative recommendation, which ultimately everyone immediately understands. Yes, be likable, be kind, and at the same time, be hard in terms of your negotiation skills. Yes, in terms of solving the problem. Yes, you're not there to concede. You're there to fulfill your interests. And to fulfill your interests, it's a skill, which means something that we can learn and improve. Yes? So be a well-trained panda.
Well-trained panda. I like that. That's a great way to end the episode. Remy, thank you very much for sharing your expertise and your time and the generosity of your advice and your tips. I think for me, I have learned a lot and it's complemented a lot of what I know. So thank you for that.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your kind invitation. I do certainly hope that we'll have a few Norwegian teams with us, either in a student competition or in the one for professionals later this year. Thank you so much, James.
You're welcome, Remy. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
In this episode, we've had the privilege of delving into the importance of negotiation, communication, conflict management, and building resilient relationships and resilient organizations. Dr. Remy Smolinski, our esteemed guest and negotiation professor, shared his invaluable insights that can transform the way we approach negotiations. Dr. Smolinski emphasized the significance of creating rules of engagement, particularly in international teams. Regardless of our cultural backgrounds, establishing a common understanding of what is important for the team's success can foster collaboration and effective goal achievement. We also explored Dr. Smolinski's mindset when entering negotiations. He introduced the concept of the panda bear, highlighting the importance of being prepared and strong. Even if we appear friendly or non-threatening. Just like the underestimated strength of a panda bear, we should not underestimate our own abilities to tackle complex problems head-on. Building self-confidence was another topic of discussion. And Dr. Smolinski explained that self-confidence is a function of experience and mastery. To build confidence, he offered two pieces of advice. First, continuous training and refinement of negotiation skills are essential for negotiating well. Second, comparing our skill level with others in the same field, especially during training, allows us to gauge our progress and to boost our confidence. Now, as we wrap up this episode, I hope you've gained valuable insights and strategies for negotiating effectively, managing conflicts, and fostering resilient relationships. You know, remember that negotiation is not just about reaching agreements. It's about unlocking potential and creating value for both parties involved. I want to extend my personal gratitude and thanks to you, Remy, for sharing your expertise and guiding us on some of the best techniques for building resilient relationships. If any of you are interested in the negotiation challenge, I will leave those links as well as all the links to Dr. Smolinski, if you wish to get in contact with him, in the show notes. Well, folks, that leads us to the conclusion of yet another episode. Thank you for showing up as you do every week and allowing me to be part of that week. And we will continue this conversation next week. Until then, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.